Welcome.
To a further reflection on Gada natural disasters, particularly as reflected in various biblical.
Are you turned on?
Probably not, thank you.
There we go. My knowledge of the technological world is limited indeed.
That's true.
And we're going to work a little bit at the beginning with some of the Job material and then move to the suffering material more explicitly. But I noticed that around campus there are still some village voices from a year ago. And if you're interested in, this is what, summer 2016, yeah. If you're interested in pursuing some of these things with a little different angle, somewhere in here. I have an article in here entitled God's Interdependence with Creatures in Matters of Creation. And so they're in the dining hall, I know, a number of them. So if you're interested in pursuing this or getting some of this stuff in different form, why that's a possibility. Let me come to initially say some things about the ending of Job. We didn't get there yesterday, and some of the importance of this material for our reflection on these matters. Job 38 to 41, you recall, it's in the. There are a few extra of these. Job material. The bottom of the page. Speaking of God's speeches in Job 38-41. God takes Job out of where the wild things are. And appears to Job in what the NRSV says appears to Job out of a whirlwind. It's important to note that that word whirlwind is the everyday word for storm. So you got to think of God appearing to Job in the midst of the storm. It's the same word that's used, say, at the beginning of the book of Jonah. When the storm, Jonah's trying to escape from the call and gets out on a boat on the Mediterranean Sea, and this storm that virtually destroys Jonah and everyone else, that's the word that's used here. God appeared to Job in a storm. It's not some gentle breeze. It's a prime example of nature's disorderly elements, and one could even say God appeared to Job in a natural disaster. And God discloses God's will, not simply within the natural order of things, but right in the midst of what occasioned problems for Job, namely the disorderliness of the larger creation of which he is a part. So that God's revelatory mode in the whirlwind explicitly connects with Job's concern about, God, why don't you take care of your creation a little bit more in a more orderly way than this, huh? And Job's complaint is focused on this disorder. And so this medium, if you will, of God's revelation to Job has two basic functions. On the one hand, the whirlwind is intended to convey insight into the nature of God's world. It's a disorderly place. It's a dangerous place. On the other hand, it conveys to Job the understanding that suffering may be an effect of living in this kind of world. So that God has some responsibility here for creating the kind of world which could affect human beings and other creatures in a negative way. So that is one of the things to lift up from this material is this storm, which in which God appears at the end and speaks to Job about a variety of things relative to the nature of the world. As I indicated, it's meteorology, zoology. I mean, that's the nature of the kind of conversation that takes place. And then comes to an end at the end of chapter 41. And then in chapter 42, you get Job responding to this. And I'd like to just raise a question for you to look at a little bit more carefully sometime. In verse 6 of chapter 42, the ending of Job's response before the epilogue, Job says, "Therefore I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes." And that's commonly thought to mean that, I spoke some things that were a little out of order. I apologize for that. But one of the interesting things, this is beginning to change in terms of translation. And it's almost certain that the NRSV, or any successful, it's already beginning to happen, that some of the translations here will emerge in a different form. The word, when Job says at the end, "I repent in dust and ashes," that's not the usual word for repentance of sin. It's a different word. And I changed my mind with respect to some of the things that I've been reflecting on or saying. So that the Job change of mind with respect to what he had earlier spoken has impressed him in view of this remarkable testimony with respect to the nature of the world. It should be emphasized that the book of Job is filled with questions, and so you get a variety of questions that appear in God's response to Job. And they're just question after question after question. It's filled with questions from Job initially, and God responds essentially with more questions. Just to give a couple of examples from 38, I wish I could get this on, but I can't here, so I'll leave it on. "Have you commanded the morning, 38:12, since your days began, caused the dawn to know its place, so that it might take hold of the skirts of the earth? Have you entered into the springs of the sea, or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have you comprehended the expanse of the earth? Where is the way dwelling on light? Where is the place of the darkness, that you may take it to its territory? Have you entered the storehouses of the snow?" Mark, God essentially, Job addresses all kinds of questions to God. God essentially comes back, "I've got these questions too," and consider them. And if you were to take each of God's questions to Job in 38 to 41 and address them to a Job who was a scientist, that Job would be able to answer about a third of these questions today. And so when God says, "Gird up your loins," all these questions of God to Job have been explored, many of them explored, and we've been learning how to respond to, "You know when the mountain goats came forth?" "Yeah, I know." "Do you observe the calving of the deer?" "Yes." "Can you number the months that they fulfill?" "Yes." So again and again and again, God addresses these questions to Job, and a Job of today with scientific sophistication would be able to respond to a great many of them.
What questions would God use today to Job?
That would be a question to explore. I mean, God would...
I mean, to make his point.
If this were a modern situation, God, in order to respond in a comparable way to a contemporary Job, would have to come up with different questions. at least, not all, and some of them are almost impossible questions, but others have been clarified and, you know, moved toward understanding in a whole variety of ways. So God would have to come up with a range of new questions in order to have the same effect.
Antimatter. Explain that one.
I can't spell it.
So this book is remarkable and pastorally, and something many people think, what kind of responsive is God giving to Job? We're just raising all these questions about the nature of the world. And God, I think the pastoral move here is very interesting. God responds to questions with questions. And these challenging questions from God are an invitation to Job and readers to seek even greater understanding of the world in which he lives. Yeah?
I found it interesting. I was looking through it earlier. It was questions that Job could handle. The question, the things that God was asking him would be within his sphere of possibility.
Yeah.
So the questions God would ask of us would be kind of at the periphery of our understanding of things.
Right.
To get his point across.
That would be the question raised here earlier, namely, what kind of questions would God bring to the situation today? And it would be quite different in view of the knowledge that has developed over the years. So that God's call to Job, gird up your loins, has occasioned considerable development of understanding with regard to the world in the several thousand years since those questions were addressed to Job. And a new set of questions, by and large, would have to be addressed in order to accomplish the same end. So, and it's interesting here, God seems to be honored by the impatient question of Job more than by the questions and concerns of the friends. In fact, the friends place certain questions off limits, if you will. Job gives voice to those who raise unconventional questions about the faith, about the God. Or Job gives voice to questions when people who are out and about may shush us up, think it's not appropriate to ask these kinds of questions of God. Job gives voice to those who can't find their voice in the midst of suffering. This questioning dimension of these texts is very important, I think. And God contributes, if you will, to this ongoing conversation. Yeah, let's get the questions out there. Let's work on the questions. You'll learn more about the world of which you're a part, and that will help explain considerably the suffering which you're having to endure.
So you told us that the word for repentance is different.
Yeah.
Did you tell us how it will be translated now?
Yeah, there are varying ways, but one of the ways in which that nikam is translated when human beings are the subject of the verb is change the mind.
Okay.
And so if you look at Exodus 32 verses 1-14, in verse 14, you get God determines to bring a disaster, Moses prays, and then it says God changes God's mind with respect to that dimension. And that's the same verb that's used here with regard to in Job 42:6. And there are 39 instances where God is the subject of change mind. It's not an easy dimension for reflection on God talk. What does it mean for God to change God's mind? That's another week. Okay. Okay. Other questions here? We'll leave Job behind a little bit here, but please. Let's pursue this then, if we can here, the topic, the sign for today has to do with suffering, and so...
May I have one of those?
Sure.
Job obviously has filled our minds with a variety of suffering matters. Let me pursue that issue a little bit more generally across Old Testament texts. Walk up to any person you know, and you can be, or you don't know, and you can be absolutely certain that you have, absolutely certain that you have one thing in common. You've experienced suffering. In any community that you would care to name, there is grief enough to freeze the blood. If we were to go around this room and have you tell your stories, suffering would be topic that would be raised again and again. We know that. Sometimes the suffering is evident to everybody. Sometimes it's deeply hidden. And we manage to keep our composed facades in place. However much one or another of us has suffered deeply and profoundly, no individual, no community is a corner on suffering. At the same time, the word suffering can be leveled, if you will, to refer to everything from a headache to the Holocaust, with few of any distinctions made with respect to severity and personal and social impact. Questions about suffering are more pervasive than we might think, even among good church people. People of faith seem to have as many difficult questions with regard to God and suffering as people who are outside the faith. And one of the difficulties here is the church has tended to neglect the topic. And all kinds of strange ideas have filled the room about suffering because the church has often not dealt with the issue as well as it should have. And so people draw conclusions that are remarkable. It's the will of God, etc., etc. These why questions have often been considered inappropriate to address on the part of good church people. Suffering is a mysterious reality that cannot be fathomed. And hence, a common resolution to the questions about suffering has to do with avoidance of the conversation altogether. And simply live with the mystery of suffering and care for those who are suffering. End of conversation. But can we do both? Are the only of options available to us with regard to suffering, are the only options explanation and mystery? Isn't there a middle ground between these options where some way of moving through these topics is important? Can a consideration of the issue of suffering, theologically, for example, be combined with a profound care for those who suffer? And so, hello. It's we should ask to think a little bit about the why questions. And some people say, don't go with those five questions. That's not a helpful direction to reflect about the suffering. Let me give you six reasons why I think the why questions are very important and helpful to us. One, especially good and important reason to ask the why questions is that that connects with our biblical moorings in significant ways. The biblical texts are filled with questions of why and how long, regarding both individual suffering situations and communal suffering situations. These questions to God are there again and again and again. In fact, you go to Jesus' life, and Jesus has got these why questions of, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from helping me from the words of my groaning? And those come from Psalm 22. Or here from Psalm 44. Why, O Lord, do you hide your face? Why do you forget our afflictions and oppression? Or Jeremiah 15. Why, O Lord, is my pain unceasing, my wound incurable? Or Lamentations 5. Why, O Lord, have you forgotten us completely? Why have you forsaken us all these many days? Again and again you get these questions addressed to God. Why questions? And one key factor as to why these why questions continue to be important then is that they're reflected in the conversation about these issues in the scriptures themselves. So a second factor as to why these questions should be pursued is insight and it may be gained into issues that may help relieve suffering. Medical research with regard to childhood illnesses, for example. Knowledge of weather patterns. Just think of our increased knowledge of weather patterns. How many lives have been saved? Because we have taken up the Jobin questions, explored them, and it has made us, helped us understand the world in better ways. To know the sources of suffering, to develop healing responses, may affect real change, important change. So get the why questions out there. They may in fact develop more full understandings of the world of which we're a part. A third factor, and this gets a little close to home sometimes, we often don't realize the extent to which our own words and our own actions have caused the suffering, including the often hidden suffering of the poor and the underprivileged. And ignoring or diminishing the why questions is a remarkably easy way to escape from our own complicity in such matters. We need to be confronted more directly with our participation in the causes of the suffering of others. And if we put the why questions off, sort of off limits, then we're not going to be hit, if you will, with these issues as often or as directly. A fourth reason why the why questions are important. Such lively question may enable us to explore more openly our own suffering and that of others in a community context, with the result that the wisdom and counsel of others can be drawn into a conversation that is all too commonly focused on our self. And this approach can help move us away from a fear of what others may think of us. What did she do that she is suffering so much? A fifth factor, we may be better prepared to work with the questions about suffering that come from persons of faith and those who are detractors of the faith. A dismissal of the why questions may actually not diminish them. It will often, that dismissing of the why questions may often drive the questions underground, where they can fester and emerge in ways that are harmful to individuals and communities. So, you know, oftentimes people don't like the why questions because it challenges their understanding of the faith. Ah, you've got to think a little differently about God if you consider these why questions carefully and thoroughly. And people don't want to go there oftentimes. And I think that these questions can help us there. And sixth, such considerations may be of help to us in pursuing an even more important question. What are you going to do with the suffering of others? So whence questions, where does the suffering come from, can finally move to whither questions if we would be appropriately engaged in these issues. But I think the whence questions need very careful attention so that the whither questions, what are you going to do about this situation, can take on flesh and help us chart a helpful vision into the future. So those are some of the reasons why I think the why questions are so important and why the biblical materials themselves lift up the why questions. But questions, comments from you here, any issues? Yes, please.
A profound thing for me was reading John Westerhoff saying that you cannot effectively preach or teach until you come into connection with your own pain. Oh. And when you realize your own pain, you're able to wound to work with the other.
Oh, very good. Very helpful. Thank you. And that, by the way, that author is, just mention him again, Westerhoff.
John Westerhoff.
Yeah, his writings are very helpful on this particular topic. Yes, please.
It always disturbs me a little bit when people justify their own ideas about suffering by their beliefs and by what ultimately happens to them. So I was just reading a book about a lady that had an afterlife experience, you know, or she supposedly died and then came back. And I'm not saying that doesn't happen, but, you know, then she was saying that God saved me. Well, if she hadn't lived, then does that mean,
yeah,
you know, it's like, yeah, so.
Well, the fact that you're raising questions about some of these understandings that you've heard is a wonderful thing. And so keep addressing them, keep opening them up. I mean, we're often not going to be receive nice and easy answers with regard to the questions that we raise. I mean, getting them out there, exploring them, can be very helpful, particularly finally in ministering to others who are moving through a time of suffering. Please.
A group of us in my church years ago took a class or a course on grief, because we wanted to be grief counselors and help other people. And the first thing we learned is that we had to work through our own grieving before we could help anybody else.
Yes. I think there's kind of a yes and no in my response to that. You work, at least you're working at it, if not through it. Okay. You're considering an important issue that you yourself have. And that can be of great importance in your working with others who are passing through such a time, indeed. Yes, please.
Well, suffering can be such a huge issue. And one approach to keep our mental health sanity is to realize that there's a lot that is not in our control. The Serenity Prayer, for example, help me to accept what I cannot change, right? So the question is that all right to dismiss some of the suffering because I just can't deal with it and it's beyond me and I can't solve all the problems of the world? Or is that a cop-out?
Well, my concern in laying out those six factors that I think raised the level of importance of such why questions, I think carefully consider those six factors, or you know, several of them, as you ponder such a question. I think we need to work at this very carefully, passionately, and let's see where that conversation can bring us. But you wanted to push it maybe in a little different direction?
I think it's overwhelming to try to address the suffering in the world. And
I mean, it's difficult, for sure. But not is it necessarily overwhelming? Wouldn't the church's careful consideration raising of these questions be helpful in confronting the suffering issues which sometimes overwhelm us? Yes?
Well, because I think I hear you when I was working with the women of the ELCA. And we
speak up a little bit, please.
And we... Really? Yeah. I've never heard you say that before. and we would go to various countries or whatever and talk about the issues there. And the very same things were said to us. This is overwhelming. We can't do anything about this. But focusing in on one issue, for example, in Africa with female genital mutilation. And this sweet 70-something-year-old lady came and said, I can't do anything about this. And I said, well, you could go home to your synod and talk about it. No, you can't do anything about it here. But you can go home and raise awareness and talk about it. And she brought a resolution to the Rochester Synod. I mean, it's doing the little things maybe that seem little. Because the big ones do overwhelm you. Did I talk loud enough?
Yes.
Maybe doing what you can when you can.
Yep, that's what you said.
Because I think, I hear what the person in the back... I hear what the person in the back said, that sometimes, maybe where you are in space, you can't help everybody. You know, if somebody comes to you with suffering, you may not be the right person to help them. But maybe understanding a little bit more about suffering and what you can say or what you can do can help you in another situation.
Or you might be able to refer them to people who can be of help in a way that you can. Yeah. Sure. Take a look at this sheet that I handed out. And this is an effort on my part that, following from Douglas John Hall's book, God and Human Suffering, that book by Hall, by the way, Augsburg Fortress, it's now, 30 years old, still selling well, and I've used it in several classes. Most students find that very helpful reflection. And that's echoed in some of the material that follows here, that we need to make some distinctions within the category of suffering. And let's just quickly note the four and get the four before us and come back and look at several of them in a little bit more detail. A, suffering as a part of God's good creation. Suffering as becoming. That's his language, that's Hall's language. Suffering as becoming. And B, well, maybe skip down to D. Suffering as vocational. Suffering that could be avoided, but is taken on to enter into the lives of others who are suffering, bearing the cross. So A and D are in many ways positive understandings of suffering. In the middle, you get B, suffering as a consequence of sin, so that a sin can distort or intensify creational suffering, and C, suffering as tragic, systemic, structural, like racism, sexism, ageism, and so forth, sometimes equals evil. And that the cumulative effects of sin and evil over time get built into the infrastructure of life and take on a life of their own. And finally, in late biblical materials, they're even personalized to refer to the devil, Satan. Let's look a little bit closer at A. Suffering as God's good creation, suffering as becoming. We are finite creatures with limits of strength, intelligence, agility, and suffering occurs when there are when those limits are stretched. It could be good. No pain, no gain. Suffering not from sins committed, but from mistakes made because of limits. All too often, people collapse sin and mistake. Needs to be a careful distinction made there and worked with. We make mistakes often because we're finite. We're people with limits, and that needs to be more carefully worked through. Listen to these words from Douglas John Hall. A pain-free life would be a lifeless life. Life depends in some mysterious way on the struggle to be. If nothing were inaccessible, nothing out of reach, and there were no unfulfilled dreams or wishes, there would also be no wonder, no surprise, and no gratitude. No pain, no gain. It's God created, as we've indicated, a risky world and a dangerous world. Potential for suffering is real. No little care is necessary if one would live in this kind of world. So, if Adam and Eve had, before sin, had fallen and broken their arm or leg, it would have hurt. Pain, hurt, would be an integral part of the world, quite apart from sin. Sin can intensify the risk, can intensify the pain, but even without sin, suffering would be an integral part of the world in which we live. Let me say something about randomness here. As a factor. Let me turn to, easy to remember, Ecclesiastes 9:11. Ecclesiastes 9:11 and 12. And just lift this up. God created this kind of world. So again I saw that under the sun, the race is not to the swift. Should be, right? The race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, nor favor to the skillful. You'd think so, but time and chance happen to them all. Have you got room in your understanding of God for chance? It's a biblical theme. It's not common, but it's there. Time and chance happen to them all. It continues verse 12. For no one can anticipate the time of disaster. Like fish taken on a cruel net, like birds caught in a snare, so mortals are snared in the time of calamity when it suddenly falls on them. You may be intelligent, you may be fast, you may be skillful, but you may have experience chance, and that may be a devastating moment. One thinks of random encounters with certain storms, viruses, the randomness of the gene pool. It's been said that there's no lifeguard at the gene pool. Randomness, that the characteristic of the world of which we're a part, can lead to suffering again and again. I'm struck over the years of the number of times that the birth of, say, disabled children have created havoc in people's lives. Randomness remains an important but often unrecognized factor in the life of the church in thinking through suffering. And I think to know of the reality of randomness can be theologically and pastorally helpful. Listen to these words from John Polkinghorne. John Polkinghorne is a physicist theologian, British. He was a physicist for a generation or so before he became a theologian. And his book, Quarks, Chaos, and Christianity, is a very helpful reflection on some of these issues. Listen to Polkinghorne. The created order looks like a package deal. Exactly the same biochemical processes that enable cells to mutate, making evolution possible, are those that enable cells to become cancerous and generate tumors. You can't have one without the other. In other words, the possibility of disease is not an accident, it's a necessary cost of life. The possibility of disease is an integral part of God's good creation. Even if there had been no sin, cancer would have been a part of the life we created. So it's, an important reflection. Questions here, comments? Anything here that strikes you helpful? Yes, please.
Oh, I was just curious, earlier on, about 2 minutes ago, you were talking about the positive effects, the positive effects of suffering on birth, that it's a strength and it's a necessary element, and some very positive attributes to it. It's the resolution of suffering, but, the incredible promise of heaven is a life of no suffering. And so those positive attributes somewhat drop out.
And one wonders whether there will not be suffering in heaven.
Oh, that's nice.
I would just invite you, God will wipe away all tears. There are tears to wipe away. That's an interesting way of sort of bending that a little bit and thinking about the fact that that characteristic of a world which can... something in my system here that's attracting this flood. But I just invite you to think about that possible understanding of things. There's a new heaven and a new earth, and given the earthiness of that new reality, the characteristics of an earthy life, be some continuity between now and then, I think. So I just invite you to think through that possibility. It would be, suffering would have different effects, different intensities, different long-term effects on our life together. But I wonder if, in fact, it's not going to be a part of the new heaven and the new earth. It's earth. It's a new earth. Invite you to think about that understanding a little bit. And it may be uncomfortable to think that there will be suffering in heaven, but maybe they'll have different effects and different ways of working through that in that new context.
Gosh, I hope not.
come back for I've often thought that, gosh, I hope not. But come back to the statement that we sometimes used, I used it, no pain, no gain. Could that be an understanding that would carry over into the new life in ways that we have difficulty understanding, but it's a reality?
To the thought of that, there would be people who could gain and not gain in heaven seems to me to be impossible.
Say that again. People
thought that there would be people, spirits, that could gain and others not gain in heaven would seem to me to be a problem. That seems to be
In the new heaven and the new earth, there will be a lot of changes. And so the way in which with which people cope with suffering or seek to come to terms with that, relate to others with it, will be more profound, more beneficial. So there will be some remarkable changes in the way in which people understand suffering and relate to others who suffer. But I wonder if we shouldn't think carefully about the new heaven and the new earth in which suffering of sorts takes place. The tears will be wiped away.
We will have new understanding of suffering rather than...
I'm sorry, my...
Maybe we'll have new understandings of suffering, so the suffering doesn't cause us suffering, but it causes us wisdom. Maybe it's not.
I think that's true, that we will have new understandings in that context. And we can't always discern what those understandings might be. I just would invite you to think carefully about that. It's suffering of some sort. Not as intense, maybe. But still present in our lives. Yes, please.
Sometimes when I can't believe I'm recalling that I've actually thought about that. But that Revelation text, I've often wondered if those in heaven have an awareness still of their families, for example, on earth, and suffering that they're going through, which would bring suffering to my observation. It seems a little superstitious, but on the other hand, at times I go there.
Okay.
And that would be a suffering if I was watching my grandchildren suffer here on earth while I'm in the presence of God.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I play with sometimes.
It's a good theme, good idea to play with. Just I would invite you, don't put the question off limits. Ponder it. Think about it. Suffering is an integral part of what it means to live in the new heaven and a new earth. Our experience will be different, our understandings will be different, more sophisticated, but I wonder if we're diminishing what that new heaven and earth will be like by completely dismissing the idea that suffering will not be present. Let's come back to the sheet. We've looked a little bit at A there. We're finite creatures, and this being the second part under A, the being and becoming of the natural order, earthquakes and so forth. I added fires in view of the Holden experience there. The process with both order and randomness. A part of God's good creation that needs to be brought out into further conversation, I think, in the life of the church. It just is neglected too much.
We call this a luck?
Well,
I mean, this randomness kind of thing is, I mean, I've been... I'm lucky to be alive. I'm not going to go through that whole story, but I'm really lucky to be alive.
Yeah.
And at the same time now, you know, my daughter here has breast cancer. She's the one with no hair. And you can read
Mike's granddaughter's prayer, Charlotte, they made yesterday.
Where is it posted?
It's just in front of the dining room hall there.
Okay.
Dear God, you know, cure my mom from cancer. I don't want her to die. She's lucky to have you as a God. And thank you for keeping her well so far. Something like that. Mm-hmm. But I don't want her to die. So that's a random thing, you know.
Yeah.
So it goes this way or that way.
When I asked,
isn't the word we use for that? I was really lucky. But you know, maybe Jen certainly has an enlightenment. Yeah.
When I was diagnosed with cancer, the doctor said I didn't have any of the risk factors. And I asked, so
yeah.
Why? Can you explain it? And she said, bad luck.
Bad luck?
Bad luck. Other comments here?
Is luck a biblical word?
What else is there?
I don't. Chance is. I don't know luck being a translation at any particular point. Anybody?
I'm not going to comment about that, so finish that paragraph first.
But it's. But I think one does have to reckon with chance. If you want to use the language of luck for that, well, okay. Yes, please.
Well, what word or words does Job use when his wife, when Mrs. Job, as we might say, says, curse God and die.
Yeah.
And he says, are we only to praise God when things go well? Does he use any language like about chance or luck?
Yeah. There are varying perspectives in Job, and I don't know of a text which lifts up the idea of chance or the understanding of suffering in terms of chance. But I don't know of anybody, this is a personal assignment maybe, going through Job and seeing if there is might be some language in the book of Job that lifts up the theme of chance. A good agenda. Yeah.
Okay. I'll take that on.
Okay. Yeah, Paul.
Well, I think we need to keep what we're saying now in relationship to what you said about questions. Because another variable here is who makes the meaning. And there's a big difference between somebody working things through with a question and deciding that the suffering has been redemptive or even creative, and somebody trying to impose that meaning.
Okay. Impose in one-to-one or churchly position?
Either
or?
One. I mean, somebody else saying this was good for you.
Uh-huh.
I may not be able to see that yet.
Yeah.
Right.
And the questions, you know, all of the questions of Job would be meaningless if that could just be imposed. So I think that's another thing about the creativity of suffering. I agree with you, and I have loved this book by Douglas John Hall. I've used it a lot, but I think sometimes people can't hear it yet or claim it yet until the grief and anger and whatever other stages, if you will.
Yeah, one of the big issues here with regard to relationship to those who are suffering is issues of discernment.
Right.
Where are they? And the word that can be spoken will vary from time to time.
Yeah. I mean, Job's friends are an example of imposing that meaning.
Yeah, they react initially well, just being silent and surrounding him with their presence. And then they get going on their own theological perspective and create a storm. Yeah. But back there.
So how do you address the ending of Job?
I'm sorry.
How do you address the ending of Job where God restores Job?
Yeah.
Is that God saying, I'm sorry? What is that? That's an unusual situation.
Some lives that move through times of suffering end up in Job in situations which are very positive. Other lives do not. We know that. And so it's an instance of, I think the Job in positive ending is an instance, though some people think it's an addition at the end and so forth, but the it's an instance of, this is possible. The world is created in such a way that one can move through such times, and there are these positive developments that emerge finally in a given, not necessarily, by any means, but possibly. And I think that positive possibility at the end of Job is very intriguing. It opens you up that this tragedy, despair through which I'm going does not necessarily shape the way the future will be. God will be at work in ways beyond our knowing, and positive futures may be available to us beyond our Jobin experience. That's the direction I would take that particular text. Yeah. Yes, please, and then we...
Sorry. So what that means is God restoring Job was an act of God. It wasn't an act of chance. It wasn't an act of nature. It wasn't, you know, a removal of sin. It was an act of God.
Yeah. It's one of the things that I wanted to lift up today, maybe I can touch on it a little bit tomorrow, but God's actions in this world are always in through agents. And how we think about agency in the move from, say, suffering to peace and blessing is very important. And I think God has given you and me and others responsibility in helping to see through to that move.
It's your suffering.
Yeah.
Little voices.
God will be at work in such futures. There's not a kind of, you've had a very positive development, Joe. That's going to be true of everybody. I don't think we can go there. One more, maybe.
Well, I've kind of lived through Job. I won't go into detail, but what that end speaks to me is there's always hope in some form. And I used to teach in confirmation Hezekiah 3:17. Okay. The translation that said everything will turn, sweat it not, everything will turn out A-OK.
Yeah.
And the idea that God wins, and may not be the form that it looks like in the book of Job, but there's always hope.
Well, yes, but no. Too many lives move to the end without hope emerging. And so we have to struggle with that.
Well, it depends on how you define
the shape
hope.
Of the future. What?
It depends on how you define hope. I'm not saying Pollyanna.
Right. No.
Turning out, perfect.
Yeah. I'm just thinking that hopelessness is a way that life may end. So, well, tomorrow we want to think a little bit more, think questions that may emerge in your conversation, take a little closer look at this handout, and move back to a conversation that we had on the first day together, namely relationship and the future, and how that might be shaped. We've begun to talk about it today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.